welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies here at the Cato Institute. For avid listeners of the show, you might be wondering why you're hearing my voice instead of the voice of the host and co-founder of this podcast, Emma Ashford. And that's because Emma has moved on to a new position as a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. But we'll get to all that. Fortunately, I have Emma here to talk with me about that and much more. Hi, Emma. Welcome back to your own show.
Hey, this is pretty weird. Good to be back.
So Joe Biden has won the 2020 presidential election, and we'll be talking about the foreign policy implications of that. You know, Biden has certainly presented a vision of U.S. foreign policy that's distinct from the one put forward by Trump, but there's also a lot of rhetoric that can obscure the fact that he'll probably be much more likely certain policy areas that will maintain continuity through to the next administration. Emma, maybe you can clarify things. What kinds of changes to foreign policy do you see coming in a Biden administration, and what are the biggest areas of contrast?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on. I think we are a couple of days past the election being called at this point. And I think that question about continuity versus change is really the right one. Because we've seen throughout the campaign that Biden has really tried to draw a contrast with Trump on a lot of things related to foreign policy. If you look at his campaign website, it's all things like, Biden will restore U.S. leadership in the world. Biden will reinvigorate U.S. diplomacy. There's a lot of those sort of rewords that he's going to, I guess, make American foreign policy great again, is the gist of Biden's foreign policy. But it's much more a rhetorical difference than necessarily a practical one. So I could see we can get into this in more detail, but I could definitely see some areas of continuity with Trump. I think particularly the U.S.-China relationship is likely to remain relatively hostile going forward. I think it's also possible that Biden continues with Trump's talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And so there's some other areas like that where we might see general continuity, even if the rhetoric shifts. And then there's going to be some other areas where we are going to see a serious reversal. So I think U.S.-European relations, for example, Biden is not going to be openly hostile to Europe. But even there, this isn't going to be a return to the pre-Trump norm in foreign policy. So I think it's a much more mixed picture than people are probably expecting.
You know, one of the big things that has driven a lot of debate in U.S. foreign policy lately, and including the presidential campaigns this time around and last time around, is this lingering global war on terror, in the sense that people have been supporting the United States government going into all kinds of countries, particularly in the Middle East. And apparently we are engaged in active hostilities in at least something like seven countries. And the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan now seem to have extended beyond three administrations, Bush, Obama, and Trump. Do you think that a Biden administration might be more likely to begin this shift away from an overinvestment in the Middle East and the concern about terrorism to kind of shift foreign policy in a new direction in the 21st century?
So I think there's been a lot of pressure on the left, particularly the progressive left of the Democratic Party. There's been a lot of pressure to dial down the war on terror. And I think there may be some moves towards that in the Biden administration. What concerns me is this, sort of rhetorical reality divide. So we saw this throughout the Trump administration. He repeatedly said he would end all the stupid wars, and then he never actually did. He dialed up troop deployments overseas, particularly in the Middle East. And then I'm seeing a lot of commentators around the election talking about how this is the first post-war on terror election, or the first post 9/11 era election, but that elides the fact that we actually still have most of our troops overseas in these conflicts. And so the thing that really worries me is that what we might see is a lot of rhetoric about how America is pivoting away from the war on terror. We're not doing nation building anymore, but we actually maintain fairly substantive deployments in Afghanistan, Iraq, in Syria, in various places in Africa. And I think the perception is the war on terror has wound down or is winding down, when, as you know, sort of the reality is that it's actually still quite a major military engagement that we're involved in. And so I worry that the reality of that on the ground will stay largely the same, even as the public just sort of becomes less and less aware it's actually happening.
Yeah, it seems to me what you need to make that kind of shift real and complete is a determined effort to accomplish specific things. And it just doesn't seem like the Biden administration is articulating that kind of deliberate shift. You mentioned China, too, that the Biden administration will probably continue a rather hardline approach. How do you see this playing out? I mean, do you think that a typical carrot and sticks approach by a conventional administration like Biden's would presumably be, has a chance to develop and cultivate a workable relationship with China? Or are we in for more tension and conflict?
You know, I think with most things in a Biden administration, it's going to be a question of personnel, because personnel really is policy. And even more so, I think, than in your standard presidential campaign, the campaign was just not very forthcoming on foreign policy. They had a lot of working groups. They had hundreds or even thousands of foreign policy experts producing policy briefs, but it basically didn't get talked about. The campaign website, campaign speeches, all they really focused on was this general rhetorical, we're going to restore America in the world rhetoric. And that could mean so many different things. And so, you know, I think on China, as on a lot of things, it's really going to depend on sort of who comes into the administration, who ends up being Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and what it is that they're trying to do on China. So, you know, you could see two scenarios, right? You could see one where we get a relatively dovish set of advisors to Biden. And, you know, the US-China relationship doesn't become conciliatory again, but they would dial down the trade war. They wouldn't really increase military deployments, and things would probably get a little better in general. But you could see the second scenario, right, where we get somebody, you know, we get someone like Michelle Flournoy as Secretary of Defense. I think that's pretty likely. And she has talked about how the most important task for the Department of Defense is to be able to sink all of China's ships in 72 hours. So you could see this very military focused set of policies on containing China and great power competition. And so even if the trade war gets dialed down in that scenario, it's not going to dramatically improve relations. So I'm a little pessimistic. I feel like that second scenario is probably what we're driving towards.
So the Trump years were filled with a lot of sound and fury and often slipshod foreign policy that kind of frequently lacked coherence and even contradicted itself at times. From a kind of 30,000 foot view, how do you see Trump's foreign policy in its historical context? You know, what do you think these erratic 4 years will mean for the future?
Yeah, so you left off the end of the quotation, right? Sound and fury signifying nothing. I'm not actually sure that's necessarily the case, is why I mention it. I think Trump the person, Trump the erratic, tweeting late at night, shoving the president of Macedonia out the way so we can get to the front of the picture, that Trump, you know, that doesn't matter very much over the long term. And I think we're going to move past that. And it's probably not going to come back unless Trump himself comes back in 2024. But I actually see a fairly continuous strain throughout the Trump administration in foreign policy among his advisors, among senior Republicans. And I think that this is what the Republican Party's foreign policy is going to look like going forward. And that is a foreign policy that is still heavily focused on military means, a foreign policy that is really avowedly unilateral. So it pushes back. It doesn't want to be involved in multilateral organizations. It doesn't want to be working through the UN. They don't want to be signing arms control treaties. So just very unilateral potential for arms races and everything in that kind of scenario. And then, again, a vision of the US as the world's predominant power and trying to maintain that, but one that is not dependent on norms and values. So this isn't for, I think, for a lot of these Republican advisors in the administration, for a lot of Republicans in Congress, this isn't about maintaining the liberal international order. This is about maintaining American military primacy, particularly against China, for as long as possible. And I think if you look at the writings of various Trump advisors, you look at what people in Congress are saying about this, this is a strain of thought in American foreign policy that is going to persist far past Trump. And so I think that is going to be a big part of the debate 4 years from now, 8 years from now, even if Trump himself is off somewhere in retirement.
That's kind of interesting. You know, I think about sometimes the aspects of U.S. foreign policy that are intended to kind of cultivate and maintain America's dominant military and diplomatic position. And some of those things involve working through multilateral organizations and doing the kinds of things that the Trump administration has been reluctant to do. You know, acting unilaterally has a kind of cost to it that can undermine one's objective of maintaining this kind of dominance. So it's an interesting balance that I think needs to be struck in the future. The American people seem to be kind of gradually souring on many of the core elements of this activist foreign policy. But, you know, as we're saying, foreign policy is not really driven by populist engines. It's a very much of an elite engagement. And so, it's a question for me how much the overall public attitude actually influences U.S. foreign policy or just kind of drives it into the shadows. Did you have something on that? Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, I was just going to say, you know, regular listeners of this podcast know that myself and Trevor Thrall as well, you know, we debated this, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've debated this regularly on this podcast. He thinks that polling mass foreign policy opinion actually matters in foreign policy. And I tend more towards the view that you just expressed, which is that elite signaling means that a lot of what you're getting back from polling on foreign affairs is just, elite views reflected back from the public. That said, I think there are times when public polling clearly shows a distinction between masses and elites. And I do see that in some of this war on terror polling. You know, 2/3 of Republicans want to keep negotiating with the Taliban and get out of Afghanistan. It's a much higher proportion of Democrats. So, overall, the American public there is reflecting something that elites are not particularly saying. And in that case, it's probably worth listening to.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wonder where Trevor does get it right is that these things could matter more in a very long term. So as new generations begin to enter politics and policy, the preferences might gradually change. It's just I'm not quite sure that will be on a timeline that fits for, the international trends that we're seeing. That also kind of pressure the United States to conduct itself with greater caution and perhaps even revise down some of its ambitions. So, I mean, what do you think the real prospects are for a substantive restraint-oriented change beyond the Biden administration? You know, because Biden allegedly might only last one term. He might not seek re-election. So sort of a longer timeline, what do you think the prospects for a shift are?
I think it's an interesting question. I think, so two things. One is that there is this groundswell of opinion, and it doesn't necessarily have to be like all public opinion. But if you looked at the Democratic primaries, most of the candidates were advocating for a somewhat more restrained foreign policy. So unless that shifts really quite dramatically in the next 4 to 8 years, which I don't really see, then we are going to see a wave of candidates for high office, in a decade that are going to be more restrained in their thinking on foreign policy. The one sort of caveat to that is, but if it's replaced by being more hawkish on China, that's not necessarily good overall. But I think the second big thing is Kamala Harris is a relative unknown in foreign policy. She is kind of a blank slate. And she is very likely to be the front runner. So if Biden ends up becoming a one-term president, as he's not quite committed, but he said he may well do, and he'll be quite old come 2024. Harris is the obvious frontrunner, being groomed to be the president. And, you know, she's quite progressive on domestic issues, but she has no foreign policy experience at all. And so, you know, to some extent, she'll probably learn and absorb things in a Biden administration that will help to shape her foreign policy views. But equally, we just don't know what her foreign policy views might be. She might end up being more progressive on these issues, or she might end up being quite centrist. And there's really just no way to know without waiting a few years to see what it is she actually does and says on foreign policy.
The country is still dealing with a pressing crisis of a pandemic. COVID-19 continues to spike in various places across the country. And I think in a lot of ways, this crisis has had foreign policy implications for the United States. We talked earlier about multilateralism versus unilateralism. And this is one of those things that doesn't really abide by borders. And so it basically requires collective action between international actors to make serious progress on it and create global health. How do you think the COVID crisis has impacted U.S. foreign policy, U.S. power overall?
Yeah, so, obviously we've all been watching sort of the train wreck that was the Trump administration trying to handle the coronavirus crisis. And something I'll be very interested to see. So we had some really good news. I think by the time you listen to this, it'll be last week. But we had some very good news recently from Pfizer, who says that their vaccine is effective against coronavirus. And so by 2021, we may actually be looking at a vaccine. And from the point of view of foreign policy, what I'll be really interested to watch is the Trump administration basically pursued a course of what you might call vaccine nationalism, right? The idea that American companies, whatever they develop, it would be given to Americans first. Everybody else in the world is going to have to wait. I'll be very interested to see if a Biden administration instead turns around and starts working with some of these things like, Bill Gates has a sort of international vaccine consortium where they're, setting up factories and trying to push out vaccines, into developing countries that maybe can't afford the infrastructure themselves. And that's something I could see a Biden administration really sort of committing to, where a Trump administration would very much have sort of kept everything for Americans. And so I think if a Biden administration does that, it's going to be good for the U.S. image, particularly after 4 years of Trump being so hostile pretty much to everyone else in the world. Where I think the coronavirus might have more of an impact on U.S. power, though, is in some of the long-term economic implications. So what we've seen is that there have been very few short-term sort of U.S. military or power implications from coronavirus. You know, we had the readiness crises around about the time of the U.S. Teddy Roosevelt, where they had like hundreds of cases on an aircraft carrier, and there was a scandal in the military over whether it should be docked or not. But actually, the U.S. military's recovered pretty well from that. If you just look at sort of the numbers, they've handled coronavirus better than the U.S. population at large has. And because that population is so much younger and fitter and healthier, they're also pretty much recovering at a much better rate. So even now there are, U.S. military exercises going ahead. So there haven't been any long-term sort of military readiness implications. Over the longer term, though, the question is about economics, right? So the economy obviously has taken a massive hit from the coronavirus, and has really kind of bifurcated into this two-tier economy, right? So people like you or I, John, who can do our jobs remotely, we're still working, doing our fairly normal lives, even if we don't go out very much. But people in more service industry or blue-collar workforces, the ones that can't necessarily go out to work or where the demand is just not there, shops, restaurants, recreation and leisure and holidays and all of these things, they're suffering quite a lot. And the stimulus from earlier this summer has run out. And I think no matter which way that ends up turning out, it could be a long-term economic problem. So if a Biden administration manages to get more stimulus passed, then there are long-term debt and deficit implications of that. And even if the debt and deficit is not a national security problem, and I think, you know, that's a different debate, even if it's not, the conversation will then crowd out spending on other areas like infrastructure that actually help to produce sort of America's human resource and power base. And so if they don't manage to do stimulus, there's the potential for this long-term economic stagnation, or what they're calling a K-shaped recovery, where the American economy basically bifurcates over the long term. And so none of this is good long term for the health of the US economy. And that means that down the road, it could be harmful for sort of American power in the world. Now, you know, the optimist says, well, maybe that'll force America to adopt a more restrained foreign policy. And that would be absolutely awesome if it's true. But the pessimist in me says that no, it's just going to result in military budgets sucking up more and more discretionary spending, tax increases, and things like that. So, you know, so I think we focused most of this conversation on, you know, the presidential transition, a Biden administration. I think actually what happens with coronavirus over the next 6 months may be more impactful for American foreign policy, you know, in a decade's time.
You know, that's very interesting, because on the one hand, policymakers have to deal with the practical implications of, you know, spending on COVID and how that might pressure other budgets. But on the other hand, there's another way to look for it. And my hope for this kind of insight is perhaps naive. But, you know, since we're dealing with this pandemic crisis, it might behoove some policymakers to make note of the fact that perhaps we've overspent or overinvested on the wrong kinds of threats, threats that just are not as direct and as likely as things like global public health and the risk of pandemics. And that kind of insight, I'm not quite sure has landed. Instead, I think the incentives are more to just spend more in every area and not really worry about debt and deficits. And that's really unfortunate. This last thing I want to talk to you about is your career move. You came to Cato back in 2014. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. September 2014.
And a lot has happened in DC foreign policy spaces since then. And your move to the Atlantic is kind of indicative of some of those changes, right?
I think so. Yeah. So you're right. I came to Cato in late 2014. To put that in sort of historical perspective, you know, when I arrived at Cato, Vladimir Putin had invaded Ukraine just a few months before, about 6 months before. Barack Obama was president. The war in the Arab Spring had only been going for a couple of years. The Syrian civil war still looked like Bashar Assad might lose. It was a very different world, or perhaps not as much a different world as everyone in DC thought it was a different world. And when I came to Cato straight out of my PhD, I came to Cato as a fairly mainstream, like, realist restrainer. You know, in 1990-1991, I would have been a George H.W. Bush Republican, right? Fairly mainstream realist on foreign policy. But in 2014, when I landed at Cato, Cato was one of the very few places where somebody like me could actually work in DC because of the sort of dominance of either liberal internationalism or neoconservatism in various institutions in the city. And the change that John's kind of alluding to, and something that I'm frankly thrilled to see, is that that's no longer the case. And so I've moved to the Atlantic Council, where we're setting up a new initiative. It's called the New American Engagement Initiative. And the idea is basically to talk not just about the things that America shouldn't be doing around the world, but how can we actually sort of engage with the world without just using our military? How can we do this in a better way without just withdrawing from the world? And so there's this in the Atlantic Council, there's the new Quincy Institute setting up to talk about restraint more broadly. And there's several other sort of initiatives around the city, all of which are starting to talk about more restrained foreign policy. And so, you know, it really is a very different world in Washington, D.C., in terms of the ideas that you can express in foreign policy and in terms of what's getting traction. And so despite the, you know, sort of the disaster that was the last 4 years of Donald Trump, I think that is one positive change that he actually has contributed, is because he basically smashed a bunch of assumptions about U.S. foreign policy and then didn't provide any answers, it has left a space open where people like me or like John could come in and can question what's going on with U.S. foreign policy and try and actually find solutions to those problems. So, you know, even though we're going into a Biden administration with a fairly mainstream Democratic candidate, I am excited that the landscape in Washington has changed. And I think the policy discussions that we're having now are so much more open and varied than the discussions that were happening in 2016 when we thought it would be a Hillary Clinton presidency.
You know, I remember when you came to Cato. I was in a different position then. I remember we were having some conversation about, you know, writing op-eds or something like this. And you were like, listen, man, I've been in academia a long time. You know, I don't know how well I can write for popular audiences and stuff like that. And that modesty was turned out to be entirely misplaced. Very quickly, Emma became our biggest asset, and she does the think tank thing like she was born for it. So we were sad to see her leave Cato, but you know, I know that she'll have a long career in this space and have a major impact. And her time at the Atlantic is going to be very fruitful. Thank you, Emma, for joining and for passing the torch to me on this podcast.
Thank you to our production team, Tyler Shanahan, Cecil Sherman, and Jonathan Allen. Thank you all for listening. If you want to continue the conversation, our Twitter handle is @CatoFP. And if you like the show, leave us a good review on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts.